This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. The United Nations Population Fund, or UNFPA, recently released their 2019 State of the World report. Today, we discuss the findings and what will it take to provide basic rights for all and to improve a person's autonomy over their bodies with access to proper sexual and reproductive health. Joining me on the show today are Sivananthi Thanenthiran. She is the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Centre for Women, or better known as ARRO, and Marcella Suazo, the Malaysia Representative for the United Nations Population Fund Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Siva and Marcella.
Good afternoon, Kelly.
Good afternoon, Kelly. It's a great pleasure to be here.
So, Marcella, maybe you could give us a little bit of a backgrounder on UNFPA. You know, why was it created? What was the goals and objective behind that?
UNFPA was created back in 1969. And at the time, there was a concern because in only 17 years, the population growth had been 1 billion. Mm-hmm. Up from about the half of the population that we have today, 3.6 billion. And so they were concerned that in only 17 years, the population had grown for another billion. And one of the main reasons was to really strengthen the capacities of the member states and the countries to have these national institutions of statistics, mm-hmm. so that they could really have the knowledge on the population and the population trends and the dynamics they were having. Also, these very closely related to the rates of poverty. Remember that at that time, most of the countries in the world were facing serious poverty rates.
Okay. And so this year's report is titled Unfinished Business, The Pursuit of Rights and Choices for All. What were the main findings this year?
I think that one of the things that we need to say is that in 1994, 179 countries decided that the person should be at the center of development. So after these 25 years, these reports brings to the attention of the world, what has happened in those 25 years? What have we achieved? What are the good lessons that we have learned? What are the new experiences and initiatives that we can still share today with other countries that are facing difficulties? And what are those gaps? And I would say that we still have many different gaps. We still have women that today cannot decide on the number and the spacing of the children they would like to have, and if they would like to have children. Mm. I believe that there's a huge gap in addressing issues related to gender-based violence, to women's violence, and to sexual violence in around the world today, and particularly also in this region. And there is one third, and it's the women's empowerment to make decisions. And this has to do with the economic, with the institutional, with the cultural, and the concept, the general concept of the role that women play in society.
Mm. And how many women were surveyed? You know, in how many countries did the report focus on?
The report really relates to all of the countries in which we serve, but there were particular new indicators that were reviewed. And this was the capacity of women to decide, for example, if they wanted to have an intimate relationship or not, and what is their approach and their decisions made on their own body. And this was done in 51 countries, because those are the 51 countries that provided information about this, okay. And including sexual orientation, for example. And what we found is that the issue remains the same. The capacity of making decisions lies in the power that has the economic capacity. Mm-hmm. So this disparity in the power of decision-making continues to be both at the intimate part of the family or the relationship between the couple and also in society. It is reflected in society. So this is the essence that we need to review in the legislation, in the institutional, in the cultural areas of the country.
And Siva, how does Malaysia fare in the report?
I think that when you talk about sexual and reproductive health and rights, we must firstly remember that, you know, this agenda covers a wide spectrum of issues, actually. Mm-hmm. So you have, on the one hand, more traditional health services such as maternal health services. And we know that Malaysia's achievements in reducing maternal mortality, you know, has been evident even from the 70s, right? Mm-hmm. And they achieved it largely through enabling access and professionalizing and midwifery services. And this is still, I mean, one of the achievements that, you know, every country in the world talks about when they talk about Malaysia's achievements. But it also includes access to contraception and family planning. And unfortunately, I think that the numbers around contraception and family planning is not counted accurately enough in the country. And but what number we do have actually shows that it's has stagnated for almost the last 20 years. So clearly there are some improvements that can be done, either one in the data collection around that, or two around you know, improving access and perhaps focusing on the groups that don't have that access, right? But also Malaysia does relatively well in things like, I was just talking to Marcella just before we came here, that, you know, we do make certain bold moves, like when we decided that we needed to have universal cervical cancer vaccine. And that was remarkable for a middle-income country to say that they were going to provide this vaccine, which is considered, you know, comparably expensive, right? And they were going to provide it to all girls at 12 years old, right? So I think that in that cases, you know, we asked, we continue to be bold and, you know, make steps ahead. But there's still issues. And I think that the lagging is, as Marcella pointed out, is perhaps in the rights dimensions, you know? So I think that, you know, providing access to comprehensive sexuality education or sex education, whatever you call it, there's still, you know, as a right to information for young people. This is something that we face barriers with. You know, female genital cutting is something that we still don't talk about. Yeah. Early age marriage is another issue that also, and all of these issues actually hinder, you know, women's sexual and reproductive health, you know, individual empowerment, right? So I think that these are some of those, I mean, overview snapshot that I could give, yes.
And the report also talks about marginalized groups. And in particular, they face some of the highest unmet needs for sexual and reproductive health services. So who are these marginalized groups, you know, that the report refers to that are subject to this discrimination?
Well, historically, the marginalized groups are all of those groups that have been excluded from their access to the programs and the policies that are making the availability of the use of family planning services, including contraception. In this case, it is important to mention that in many countries, what we have seen is that the 20% of the bottom of the up population group that have more economic capacity buy the services and are able to pay for those services. So the marginalized and the excluded populations are the ones that do not have enough resources to pay for their own services. So we talk about groups that are usually excluded because of legal barriers. And we could say sometimes that, for example, legal migrant workers in certain countries are not able to exercise their sexual and reproductive health and rights. Sometimes it is cultural barriers that we believe that certain age groups should not be getting into intimate relations. So we do not want to provide as healthcare servers the service and the knowledge and the information to these groups, or the ones that are geographically very far away, that the outreach is not appropriate and adequate to serve them.
So I am speaking to Sivananthi Thanantharan. She is the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Centre for Women, or better known as ARRO, and Marcela Suazo, who is the Malaysia Representative for the United Nations Population Fund. And we are discussing the 2019 State of the World Population Report. We will be right back after the break. BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Live and Learn on the Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. Today, I am speaking to Sivananthi Thanantharan, who is the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Centre for Women, or better known as ARRO, and Marcela Suazo, who is the Malaysia Representative for the United Nations Population Fund. We are discussing the 2019 State of the World Population Report. So, Marcela, based on the report, which countries showed the greatest sexual and reproductive autonomy amongst women?
Well, we can say that based on the report, we see the countries in Europe, particularly, for example, UK and other countries in Europe that would exercise. We have a higher mm-hmm. rate of exercise. But the issue is in contraceptive prevalence, that this is what we're looking at. And we have, you know, countries that are much less performing, like South Sudan, for example, which is around 7%. Mm-hmm. I think that the most important thing to highlight is the countries that are able to have stronger human rights platforms that really constitute the approach to legislation and to institutional decisions, really empower much more their populations. And we have seen throughout history that given this empowerment and supporting these basic decisions for a person really empowers them enough to provide support to economic development for the country. So it is connected.
So you mentioned South Sudan earlier. Was that one of the countries that didn't fare very well in the report? You know, are there other countries?
Well, we also talk about Chad. We also talk about certain countries in areas of the world that are still facing several challenges, not only access to family planning, but several challenges. But what we would say is that it's not only access to family planning, which would empower a person. Mm-hmm. It is the information. And in this case, we really support the comprehensive sexuality education. It is access to information, and it is the access to the services. Access to the services, as Siva was saying, is key and fundamental. And the platform of laws that supports this access is the game changer, is the key to open up this for the population.
And this year is also the anniversary of the International Conference on Population and Development, or ICPD, which was a meeting that took place in Cairo where 179 governments adopted a revolutionary program of action and which called for women's reproductive health and rights to take center stage. So that was in 1994, and this year marked its 25th anniversary since that meeting. So Siva, you were one of those who attended the launch and were also part of that panel in April. Could you briefly just go through what the ICPD is about and how it changed the conversation of women's reproductive health and rights since?
Yes, I think that till today, we still hold up Cairo and Beijing as one of those really amazing progressive agendas, right? Mm-hmm. And the 90s were that time period because you had Rio, which was dealing with the environment, you had Cairo, and then the next year, which was about sexual and reproductive health and rights, and then you had Beijing, which was about women's rights, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I think that at that time, that global scenario, I mean, it was an amazing time because the global scenario had all of this progressive norm-setting agendas, you know, that they had actually put on the world stage, right? Mm-hmm. And at that time, many of the developing countries as well were actually committed to an idea of holistic development, you know, which is why I think that they signed on to all of these documents. And then somehow it seems to have taken 25 years later, we can still question, actually full implementation, you know, of mm-hmm. Those programs of actions or the platforms of actions that came out. So it was actually the first time the ICPD actually called for, as Marcella said, you know, to put the focus on individuals and families as compared to looking at people as targets, you know, and demographic targets, right? So I think that putting the focus on the individual meant, you know, talking about what are the rights that individuals had, you know, around population and sexual and reproductive health matters, right? And then putting the focus again on, because of their rights, you know, their ability to make decisions, which meant that they had to have, you know, right to information, right to counseling, right to access those health services and a range of health services. And even when they access those health services, the right to make decisions about it. Right. And this was revolutionary because the conference actually came from, you know, that era where we know of large coercive family planning programs that were taking place in other countries like China and India. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, the focus on the individual as versus the focus on, you know, national programs. So I think that this is over the years, we've also been able to expand to actually realize the fullness of what that person's rights, an individual's rights or a couple's rights within the framework means, you know. So I think that it's been really great. And surprisingly enough, I mean, Arrow has actually was one of those NGOs set up in order to, as a preparatory organization, you know, before 1994, because they did the regional preparatory committee meetings, or the, what is called the PrepComs in UN jargon, and so and then so we've been actually been involved in following and monitoring the ICPD Cairo from 1994. Yeah,
how would you rate the progress that has been made?
Yeah, I think that, you know, progress is like, you know, it's has not always been linear. We always hope that development takes place in this linear space, right? We want to go from A to B and, you know, get to 100%, you know, by a certain time. And I think definitely when we started with Cairo in Beijing, we had that idea. So progress has actually been sketchy, I think. And we can say across countries and across the region as a whole, and across, if you compare even the regions of the world, right? And this is because, you know, governments face maybe prioritization due to constraints of revenue, right? And this has led to some types of services being kind of emphasized over others. So you can see that in some countries, the emphasis on family planning and contraception is very high. Maybe there is lesser emphasis on reproductive health, like reproductive cancers, right? So, I mean, and these are choices and decisions that governments make around it. But I think it is to recognize where the gaps are. The second is, of course, who receives the services and who doesn't get to receive the services. And we can tell you that, you know, if you look at any data set across any country, there are marginalized groups. And sometimes when we think of marginalized groups, we are thinking of small groups. Yeah. But, you know, if you just talk about a rural population, I mean, we live in a region where 40 to 50% of our entire region, Asia Pacific, lives in rural areas. And rural area people who live in rural areas do not get the services because, you know, it's very hard for them to travel. They may not have the money to access those services. So, you know, so we have to look at some of these people who are, whom we term as marginalized, right? So the rural is one. The second is, of course, those who belong to lower income groups. Right. So lower income groups may face a lot of barriers in actually accessing all of the services. Right. You can have young people who are not married, who may not feel comfortable to go to certain clinics or certain hospitals in order to get the services that they receive simply because of the age factor. So I think that and then, of course, as Marcella has said, you know, groups such as migrant workers, indigenous populations may, due to their circumstances, be marginalized from those services. And this is actually something that is evident across all countries. And that's why the focus of the SDGs is that while they have integrated a better part of the Cairo agenda in comparison to the MDGs, but this is why the SDGs talks about inequalities, you know, so we can not just go on the overall number achievement, but we can actually interrogate those numbers, right, and see where is the services for marginalized groups. Yeah. So, for example, even if you have a good number, like in Malaysia for maternal mortality rate, we do know that perhaps East Malaysia, like Sabah, Sarawak, the numbers are higher. So we know that that they are having circumstances that we need to actually program better for, or migrant workers, you know, or indigenous population. So we need to interrogate the larger numbers.
And so earlier when we spoke about barriers when it comes to sexual and reproductive health and just really basic rights, such as the lack of sexual education, for example, what is the greatest challenge when it comes to overcoming those barriers?
Well, I think that, barriers are something that, you know, I think there are two types of barriers. I think there are physical barriers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the physical barriers actually can be very great. For example, if you live in East Malaysia and you live in a village, you know, and accessing the health center requires you to travel 3 hours by boat and then another additional 2 hours by a bus, you know, I mean, so that's like a physical barrier, right? Mm-hmm. Then you have a cost barrier. Right, the cost barrier could be that even if I need to have a surgery, I may not be able to have the resources to raise the money up front. So those are, and some of these actually affect women because we may have social norms that do not allow women to travel alone. Right. Yeah. So they need to be accompanied by someone. So actually, a woman going to a health center may then mean her husband has to stop either doing farming for a day. So these are not actually easy to overcome. These are real life decisions that individuals and couples have to do. So, right. The second is, of course, in cost barriers in many countries who do not have a universal health coverage top type of health service. You may actually find that individual households may not prioritize a woman's health. Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, if anything happens to the head of the household, usually the husband, then of course money is like, you know, spent on that. And if the children, especially if the male children fall sick, then, you know, that may be prioritized. But women falling sick may not be prioritized as the way to allocate a household expense, right? But then there are the barriers that sometimes the systems themselves set up, right? So the, we have to question and say, why do we not have comprehensive sexuality education when we've actually had a lot of discussions on this issue with many ministries. And I remember even as way back as like, I think almost 15 years ago, the Ministry of Women actually had a complete full syllabus, you know, but it was never rolled out, right? So I think that, and those barriers are basically about perception barriers, that somehow comprehensive sexuality education is giving information which is bad or wrong to young people. But the thing is, young people are getting the information anyway today, you know, from resources that you can't control, right? So might as well we give them the right information, you know, and see it as a means of giving them the right information. But this is, as I said, it's a perceptional social barrier. And the reason of that is because we actually come from quite a traditional conservative society, which believes that, you know, women's rights over their body is actually subject to both their father and their husband, right? And that sexuality is something that only needs to be expressed and only should be expressed within the framework of marriage. So anything that they see as a danger to that framing is considered a threat. And that's where they place the barriers like, oh, maybe we shouldn't give them the information. We shouldn't give them access to contraception and family planning because it will only encourage people to break that framework.
I think that one of the most important teachings of the International Conference on Population and Development, which we have been trying to support for the past 25 years, is that we went from counting everybody to making everyone count. Mm-hmm. So the whole purpose of the agenda is that people are not numbers, but that they have their own identity with their own and unique needs to be addressed. So another challenge that I would like to add to what Siva said is political will. Okay. And in every single case, in the countries that have advanced, in the countries that have provided a response, or the countries that are not providing an adequate response, the difference that we see is the political will. And even in the cultural barriers, let's go back to many years ago where no one wanted to have their children vaccinated because it was a cultural belief. Mm-hmm. How has that changed today? New parents today, do they even think about not vaccinating their children? So this was a whole process of educating the society to understand that the health of the children, and in this case, the health of the women, has a fundamental priority in society. And this is one of the issues. But all of it starts, you know, the kickoff is the political will that can transform these legal frameworks, that can provide what, when you have a political will, you need to support the legal frameworks, but you also need to provide prioritization of your budgets and your programs so that those can really reach the ones that are underserved.
And how is the UN tackling these issues, like the lack of information, as you just previously mentioned? You know, what strategies do they have in place to acknowledge these things?
We work very closely in support of the national institutions. In order, there are three things that we work for. One of them is promoting universal access to healthcare and to services, those that are in education, but also in the health sector, and that are friendly services, which means that are adequate to the age and the population group that they are serving. In the other area that we promote and that we support also is in the training of the healthcare workers. And we have trained around the world millions of midwives, for example, okay, in order to ensure that maternal mortality is tackled. But we need to do the extra mile, because when we have young mothers and underage mothers that are not, their bodies are biologically not ready to have a child or to give birth, they have two or three times the risk of dying than a woman that is after 20 years old that has the full body development. Mm. So just we should never confuse the moment of puberty or the onset of puberty with a full-fledged developed body that can provide or that is ready for reproductive part. And the third area is that we promote and we support the development of legal frameworks that ensure gender equality. And we give a lot of attention to addressing gender-based violence.
And of these things that you've just discussed, what would be the most, would you say, the most difficult obstacle to confront?
Well, I think in every country we find differences. But one of the issues is really ensuring that these issues are prioritized. They have to be prioritized in the development plans, in the national development plans. They have to be prioritized in the public budgets. They have to be prioritized at the highest levels of discussion across with an integrated approach across ministries, because this doesn't belong to one ministry or to one area. This has the results or the opportunities to transform this reality really are setting in different ministries. So working together and coordinating, having a coordinated approach, I would say that is one of the most difficult things. But it can be done. Mm. There are many successful initiatives, and the transformation and the impact is really provides the population and provide the individuals with much more capacity to make decisions for themselves and to transform their own lives.
And when we talk about reproductive and sexual health, especially for women, I think there's always this one-sided view where it is only a woman's duty or it's their fight, so to speak. I just want to talk about, you know, how will it also impact men, and, you know, what is the role they can play in this?
I think that there are actually many ways that men can participate or become equal partners, mm-hmm. you know, in sexual and reproductive health. I think that one of these in the earliest, I think even in Cairo, it mentions about men's equal participation, because very often it was women who were targeted as targets of family planning and contraceptive programs, mm-hmm. right, that were rolled out. However, this is one area where I think we can see across the region that male participation in contraception itself is very, very low, right? I think that, and of course, there are only two ways. Firstly, there's not been development of new methods in which they can participate in. And I think that's why I think the Gates Foundation actually put a lot of money to say, what sort of new methods of male contraception can we actually introduce to the market, right? And I think that possibly this will help, right? So the only traditional ways were usage of condoms and vasectomy, right? And these are at very, very minimal numbers across the region. I mean, less than 1% in most countries. I think with the exception, surprisingly, of Nepal, I think Nepal actually shows larger numbers in both vasectomy and condom use. And I think that this is something that we need to think about. The second is, of course, men themselves, right? I mean, there are a lot of issues that they have because they think that they cannot experience pleasure if they use condoms, and this is probably a myth, right? And I think that nowadays the next generation condoms are very much, most young people use it, don't actually seem to reduce pleasure in any way. The third is, of course, we have to talk about the relationship. And if you look at the demographic health surveys, even in countries where, you know, they had a lot of HIV transmission programs, so you go to like Cambodia, and they actually say that, and they capture this within the demographic health surveys, is that in the first few months, yes, they use condoms regularly, but as the relationship deepens, right, they actually think that the usage of condoms means that they distrust or are suspicious of their partner in some way, right? And this is actually human behavior, right? So that is something that we really need to think very creatively about, how we can actually overcome such social perceptions that they may have. So a woman asking her husband to use a condom meant like, oh, you know, darling, I think you're seeing somebody else, you know, that was the message being sent. So I think that there is a lot of things that can be done. Definitely, I know that in Indonesia, they had this Swami Siaga campaign, which is basically to encourage men to be caring and attentive in order to bring their wife, their pregnant wife, to a health center if they thought she was experiencing pain or complications, right? So, I mean, so there have been ways in which, you know, programming has helped. But I think, of course, the number one thing that we really need to create is the culture of consent, you know. And this is something that, especially in Asian societies, we have not actually explored it enough. If we want to really talk about an antidote, you know, to violence, to sexual violence, to harassment, we need to actually understand and practice, you know, the concept of consent, you know, that every interaction, every intercourse needs to be mutually desired, you know. And I think that that's something that it's really critical and, you know, a social game changer, not a legal one.
Yes, and also, you know, what is the role that the society is given to men and what is the role that it's given to women? Mm-hmm. What is it expected? For example, when a woman is pregnant, she's pregnant because she did not impregnate it herself. But, you know, there is another. That. So do we say the woman is pregnant or this couple is pregnant? Mm. Do we assign responsibility for paternity to the person that participated in this new creation of this new baby, the new human being? Do we assign the role of a provider, for example? Okay, does he continue to provide even if he's not married to the lady? Does he continue to provide even if, you know, his role in society or sometimes society does not, we assign the role of providers, but not in the full sense of the word. So they feel that they are providers, which means they are the holders of the economic power, which means that they are the holders of the decision-making power. So we assign these issues. So when your original question was why, when we talk about these issues, we usually talk about women, is because women have had to come out because the men are not doing it, the society is not doing it, the public policies are not doing it, the legislation is not doing it. So women are trying to say, listen, we are here. We did not do this alone. So let's review the roles that we are playing in society. And I think this is happening probably little by little, but I think there's more work to be done.
Okay, and I'm just going back to the report. It did state that the world's population rose to 7.7 billion in 2019, which is up from 7.6 billion in 2018. How certain governments or different countries react to population growths like this? You know, as you mentioned previously, China, they had the one-child policy. You know, why? You know, what is the best course of action to control population growth without infringing on other people's rights?
I thank you very much for this question, Kelly, because this is fundamental to all the conversation. I think the first thing that we need to say is that the word control stopped being used. We do not control the population, because what in 1994 was decided by the world is that we should provide all the enabling environment. We should empower the human person, the couple, the families, to decide for themselves. So the human rights platform in relation to access to exercise in the sexual, reproductive, and health rights is fundamental to a society. These would necessarily avoid all these kinds of solutions, because you mentioned the example of China, for example, because they wanted to control this population. But others also want to control by increasing, by pushing an increase of the population. So these are responses that are from the more controlling thinking of a state role than what we would like or what we think would be best. It is the human rights platform based approach to development.
And, can we just go into why the population growth is such a serious matter today?
I think that population growth is not necessarily a serious matter. I think what is happening because of the population growth, what are the decisions that we are making? You know, how are we using the environment, the resources that we have? What is it that we wish to have? No, there is no time in history before in which we had more resources, in which more families had a house with dignity, more families access to water, more families access to education, more people living more years, more food on the table. You know, there's still a lot of gaps, but there's no time in history that the world population was provided with the richness that we have today. Where do we set our priorities? We need to review the area of the consumption patterns. It is not an issue of how much your population grows or stops growing. It depends on the reasons why. You want your population to grow because you want to be competitive for low wages and production so that you can generate growth, economic growth. Or do you want to provide a human rights platform for development that in which the persons can really make a balanced use of the resources that they have? You know, so this is how societies and the people that represent them in government, these are the conversations that they need to have. But you need to see the population trends in connection with population dynamics. Let's say in Malaysia, for example, you have 28% of your population today that are between 10 and 24 years of age. And I mentioned this cohort because I think it is fundamentally important for Malaysia to understand that this is the population, this is the group of population, this is the group of Malaysians that is going to face two things very soon. One of them is the 4.0 Industrial Revolution. And how are they going to position themselves individually and collectively in the productive arena? And the second thing is a fast aging population. So very soon, they will also need to carry on enough economic growth to sustain an aging population. So investment and quality investment in this group of populations so that they can really perform their human rights in development is fundamental. So these are the opportunities that when we see the population trends, the population dynamics, where are we going to live in the urban? Yes, we have a lot of people in the region that's still in the rural arena. Mm. But what's going to happen very soon? Those people are going to be aging. The people that move to the urban arena are going to go back to the villages, or the people from the villages will need to readapt and come to the cities. Are the cities ready for an aged urban population? And how is this a cohort of young people today that are going to be in their middle ages very soon trying to produce for everyone? So this is the importance of measuring the population dynamics.
Right. And Siva, you were featured as one of the champions of change for being a prominent voice in tracking gaps in sexual and reproductive rights, as well as making links to issues that worsen this, such as poverty and climate change, and also for mobilizing people and policymakers. Tell us more about that. You know, what does it mean to you?
I think that this is actually a real honor and a recognition, but not for me as an individual, but I think for the organization that I just happen to be head of, you know. It's such a privilege platform to occupy, because, you know, working with Arrow, it has not only developed my own thinking and my own visibility as a perhaps as a professional, that's at a very personal level, right? Mm-hmm. But the fact that is we actually work across 17 countries, and we work with almost, I think now, 80 core partners, right, in those 17 countries. And these partners are usually national level NGOs, working very much from a women's rights and a youth rights perspective. And sometimes when you're working in an NGO, you get to check your privilege constantly, or they will be checking your privilege for you. And in such, you know, I've been privy to so many stories on the ground, so much data, so much evidence that, you know, to be personally moved, you know, by the agenda myself. So I think that, you know, we may think about, you know, how governments lack political will, but we know for sure, you know, families, communities, women on the ground, young people on the ground, they know a semblance of their rights. They know what is due to them by their governments, you know, and how do we actually enable them, you know, to ask for accountability from their governments is basically the key pathway that we work on, you know. And so, I mean, it's been a real privilege, simply because every day you go to your workplace and you're constantly revitalized, right, by the people's fight. So I think that it was really good. And I think that we've been working very closely with UNFPA. Mm-hmm. So Arrow is one of those organizations that has created the regional monitoring reports for the plus 5, the plus 10, the plus 15, the plus 20 anniversaries of Cairo. And we shall soon be making our plus 25 before Nairobi happens at the end of this year.
Congratulations on that to you and Arrow for that recognition. Yeah. So we are running out of time. Do you have a final message? Marcella, we can start with you.
Thank you very much. Before my final message, I just want to say that I am extremely privileged to be here in Malaysia, and I'm very happy that Siva was selected to be one of the champions for our world report. And this also shows that this region has much to offer, and this country also has much to offer in solutions to the rest of the world that are still facing challenges. So one of the objectives of our national office here is to reach out to those solutions so that we can share them with the rest of the world. My final message would be that I think that Malaysia has been on the right path on many areas of the ICPD, but that we still need to recognize that we have an unfinished business that we need to address together, that the United Nations Population Fund is here to support, provide technical assistance in order to move forward with this unfinished business, but that at the end, whatever is done is really in benefit of the population, is really in benefit of the human being. And this is what, if we want to build better societies, we need to give more opportunities and more access to the human rights platform.
Yeah, I think it was great being here with you, but I just wanted to reiterate two key messages. Mm-hmm. One is, of course, that political will is really, really important. And I think governments at this point, a moment in history, are really particularly challenged to provide the right to health to all their citizens, and sexual and reproductive health actually falls within that ambit. And they should actually make all, you know, have no stops in order to achieving that for their citizens. The second is, of course, recognizing women's rights in its fullest spectrum is something that is really essential, because women, at the end of the day, we are equal citizens in every society that we are mm-hmm. at, right? And on the accountability front, which is actually at the individual and organizational level, that governments only, pay heed when we start holding them accountable. And I think in that, you know, to really push that these are our rights that should be fulfilled by governments is a very important approach that we have to take in going forward in the kind of scenario that we are actually living in today.
Thank you for joining me on the show today, Marcella and Siva. I've been speaking to Sivananthi Thanenthiran. She is the Executive Director of the Asian Pacific Resource and Research Center for Women, or better known as ARRO, and Marcella Suazo, who is the Malaysia Representative for United Nations Population Fund Malaysia. We were discussing the 2019 State of the World Population Report. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Live and Learn segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.